This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Alchemy of Forever, Immortality in Speculative Fiction.
So this week, the episode suggestion comes from Jules. And am I right in saying that this episode might have been a little bit inspired by our previous recommendation?
Yeah, and that's a perfectly fair observation to make. As I mentioned probably a couple of weeks ago now, episode-wise, I watched The Old Guard, and I think it just sort of clicked a few things into place that are the sort of thoughts I would normally have over immortality as depicted in sort of books and films, etc. I thought this could be quite an interesting topic for discussion.
Yeah.
Not least because immortality sort of goes hand in hand with morality and what the framework for mortal morality actually means when you don't technically live by those rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is actually a very interesting topic. Not least, I think, because immortality and the concept of immortality or the idea of being immortal is something which has cropped up for quite a few people. You know, a lot of people have at some point thought about what it would to be, you know, what it would be to be immortal.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Because when you first really take it on board that you're not going to live forever and that ultimately whatever you do with your life, how many twists and turns you take, death is sort of waiting for you at the end of it. Everyone is going to the same destination. And it's quite a facile solution to say, oh, I wish I was immortal kind of thing. I wish I was never going to die. Without necessarily really understanding what those implications are. And I think, obviously, that's why it gets explored a lot in speculative fiction. And the other reason for it is people have then taken that to its logical conclusion and gone, but what happens if you do live forever? Before we get onto that, when I say a definition of immortality, it's in speculative fiction terms. Obviously, you can say immortality, someone who lives forever. That's the quick way of doing it. In speculative fiction, you kind of get different flavours.
You do, yeah.
Because there is there's the true immortal whereby they cannot be killed. Or if they can be killed, then they just come back. They either respawn or they're born into a new body immediately with everything that they remembered before. There's a particular set of books that I'll mention later, but at certain points of existential angst, the immortals in that try to get themselves beheaded because while their new head is regrowing, and yes, you heard me right, they literally regrow limbs and heads and things, they kind of lost all their memories. They go back developmentally and they forget things so that there's new things for them to learn. It's incredibly disturbing. But those are
that's really horrifying in some ways.
Yes, it is. It is really horrifying. It goes into a lot of graphic detail. So there you go. That's your physical, functionally true immortals. And then I suppose you have your immortals of the spirit, whereby it's very like the Force, and you know, part of them exists on forever and becomes one with this great spiritual whole, if you like. And then you have immortals which, you know, they're not going to die of old age or weakness or sickness or natural causes, but they can theoretically be killed either by sacred objects, by someone with the destiny of a god slayer or an immortal slayer, or by another immortal. And you're looking at things like, I suppose, gods and vampires there.
Yeah. I mean, also, you know, there's a lot of... One thing we will have to mention, obviously, is a lot of characters from mythology, just in general.
Yeah.
Because this is where you really, really do tend to get it. It's just these people who are ever living, except if someone else kills them.
And quite often it's something really stupid as well. It's kind of like, I am warded against all harm. except for this plant. This one plant.
This one mistletoe. If you touch me with mistletoe, I die immediately.
It's like, you cannot kill me. My heart is not in my body, and therefore my body can never die. Ah, but the hero accidentally goes up a mountain, finds a giant rock nest, and cracks the egg that happens to have the sorcerer's heart in it. So it's an interesting function of storytelling. On the one hand, it sort of looks at the existential angst of what happens if you do exist forever. And on the other hand, it looks at how do you defeat something that powerful, that impossible, that out of your league.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the first thing that we should really discuss is what makes immortality such an interesting narrative device?
Yeah, and there's quite a lot to go into here. There's a lot to unpack. I think it's like on the surface, it sounds like a really good deal, doesn't it? So if someone says to you, you never have to get sick and you never have to die, you'd kind of go, yeah, you know, most of us would probably say, yeah, I think that sounds like, okay, great. I'm on board with that. Obviously, you're missing things like, if somebody ever offers you that package, by the way, check that eternal youth is part of the deal.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you end up like the lover of that Greek goddess, who I cannot remember off the top of my head, whereby he just doesn't die, but he just gets older and older and older and more infirm.
Yeah.
And he's just trapped in this failing body, even though he won't die.
Yeah, which sounds bloody awful, to be honest.
That's typical Greek god humour for you.
Yeah. Bunch of assholes. So yeah, if someone ever does offer you immortality, make sure that eternal youth is included in that. Because otherwise you're not going to enjoy it, trust me.
No.
But also, if someone does offer you immortality, consider actually very, very carefully about what it actually means to be immortal. Because it does not actually suit the human psyche at all. Because it does not actually fit the human psyche at all.
No, it's one of those concepts that, if you say infinity and most people go, oh yeah, infinity, there's no beginning or end. And then if you really, really sit and think about it, it doesn't fit in your head. And it probably shouldn't.
Yeah. I just remember as a kid, just the first time someone said, yeah, space just goes on. And I was like, but it's got to have an end. But then the question was, what's beyond the end? Yeah. Oh God.
Yeah, it's this huge void that wants to swallow you, isn't it? This logic.
Yeah.
Which is not great. As I said, this is very much an existential angst topic in all senses.
It really is. And, you know, the thing about immortality and the thing about sort of life is that we tend to define life by death, don't we?
It's like you were saying, you know, what's beyond space if space doesn't have an end, if it has an end or what have you?
And
it's a case of, okay, well, there's life and we know at some point it's finite. If there's a cut-off date and we may not know where it is, but it is going to happen.
Yeah.
So that gives you a limited amount of time to play with. I think it's like having too much freedom. It's like the ultimate choice paralysis, isn't it? It's kind of like, there's no cutoff date. Okay, you can do anything, literally, because you're not going to die. And you're kind of like the two donkeys from Aesop's Fables, sort of starving to death between bales of straw.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, we do tend to apply a lot of meaning to life within the context that it is actually finite. And the problem is then, if you take away the end point, you're left with somebody who kind of, what happens is ultimately it's the big break of the illusion of consequence, which is that when an action is performed, there is a consequence. But if you have someone who can do pretty much whatever they want and not die, and when time sort of becomes meaningless, so let's say you perform a crime, you end up in jail, but then what? If you've lived for several hundred years, is it going to feel that long to you if you're in jail? Or, you know, could you reasonably actually be in jail? Could you just jump off a cliff? And, you know, it, like, there's loads and loads of ways in which you suddenly lack that sense of consequence. And I think over time, to be honest, if you continue to live like that, you would start to feel completely and utterly separated from everybody around you. You would lose your humanity, because humanity, I think, is actually directly tied with the fact that we are all gonna die.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in a bit more detail later, but I think it's interesting that you specifically say the word time. If you think about it, time is the only unit of measurement that actually means anything or that has any value. It's the only thing they're not making more of. It's the only thing you cannot ever get back. So, yeah, when time ceases to have any meaning, then very little else has any meaning at all.
Yeah. You're filling me with existential dread now.
We will take this in a more cheerful direction in a minute. This is us wrestling with trying to get the sheer vastness of this concept to fit somewhere within our own minds. So this is something that's picked up within speculative fiction, in that most portrayals of immortality come with serious drawbacks. So, yeah, it's a you-broke-it-you-bought-it situation, and quite often it's not all it's cracked up to be. We'll talk about some specific examples a bit later. One theory that seems to come up, even if not in so many words as this, is that only someone who is on some level truly sociopathic can completely understand what it means to be immortal and still really want it.
Yeah.
To the point where they're willing to do anything to get it.
I think that is an important distinction to say, which is to truly understand what it means to be immortal.
Yeah.
Because I think at one point, you know, in all of our lives, we think, ah, to be immortal, wouldn't that be great? And then, of course, if you actually really think about it, it's a horror show.
Yeah, it really is. If we look at some of the problems, you talked about, obviously, mentioning time. Well, let's say that time basically stops moving for you. It's moving for the rest of the world. You're seeing all these ages come to pass. You're seeing patterns of behaviour repeated over and over again in the human race. Let's say you're not someone who's particularly altruistic, but you're not someone who is sort of, oh, I'm immortal, I can rule everything, I can be the god emperor, either. You're somewhere in the middle and you're just trying to make your existence have a specific amount of meaning for you personally. Yeah. And yet all you can see are the repeats of these wars and human cruelties, and, you know, every so often you'll get a sort of flagship figure who's a really genuinely good person, and yet you'll even see the harm that comes from in sort of radiating out from them like ripples. And you'd get very, very jaded, I imagine.
Yeah, I imagine you probably would.
I mean, just think every time you come out of a Twitter storm or whatever, or you just happen to sail around the edge of one because you're too sensible to get involved. I mean, how tired do you feel that you've just seen another one? And now imagine centuries of that.
Yeah, I think that that would be very difficult, to be honest. And not only that, you know, you would also be totally alienated from what was happening. Because first of all, you'd be looking at it and you'd know exactly what was going to occur. It's almost like living your entire life without any sense of surprise.
Yeah, eventually you would be.
Yeah, you don't really get surprised anymore, nothing sort of, you know, that, and being surprised is actually quite a pleasant experience. Whereas now you just kind of feel like everything's sort of been done and that's it.
It's a bit like the whole Dr. Manhattan thing, isn't it? I mean, he's technically immortal, but hasn't really existed that long in terms of the plot of The Watchmen or what have you. But because he can manipulate matter and he can be everywhere at once and he's more or less omnipotent, nothing really surprises him.
Yeah.
There's nothing left in the universe that can really cause an emotional resonance for him.
Yeah.
Living for thousands and thousands of years would probably leave you in a similar situation. And at that point, who actually understands you except someone who's had the same experience?
Exactly. And then there's the whole of the thing, which is that you would be so totally disconnected from people because you wouldn't actually be able to have really meaningful relationships at all.
No, I mean, with the best will in the world, it would be kind of like dating a pet, and I hope that doesn't sound too weird, but if you think about it, when you bring a cat or a dog home, you know you've probably only got them for about 18 years. This is someone who comes in, becomes part of your family, and you love them, and they're going to maybe make it through, I don't know, a fifth of your lifespan, maybe less.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that people who only have, short times with one another, that's not a meaningful relationship. But what I mean is that let's say you did that the first few times, I think after a certain amount of heartbreak of having to watch somebody die, somebody get older, and die, or to be honest, I also think it's very possible that there would be, people who wouldn't actually want to willingly stay with an immortal while they got older.
No, I mean, can you imagine the resentment?
Yeah.
You'd be
resentful, but also I think there's the other problem is that as you get older, you kind of want something a bit different. And if you're immortal, then maybe you are just a bit, stuck in your time, if that makes sense. There is something to be said about growing older with somebody else.
Yeah, there is.
Being in it together.
There's definitely a romance of sorts in, taking that journey together. If one of you is constantly stuck at, I don't know, point C on the journey, then you're leaving them behind and they're also leaving you behind. Imagine doing that hundreds of times.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, all this is sort of assuming that somebody or a character in the position of having immortality would still keep some sort of human psyche. And obviously we're going to look at creatures that are not like that a bit later on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But it would be very difficult. And I think that, if you had fallen in love several times and you had relationships and then they'd either left you or they died or, something like that, it would be very difficult to commit yourself to a new kind of relationship.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it? It would be really, really hard. And when I say relationship, I don't just mean, a marriage kind of relationship. I mean a relationship with, just anybody. Friendships, things like that. It would be quite difficult, especially if you really liked someone. And you knew that they were going to die. And you also have to ask the question of, who can you tell about your immortality?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to bring in one example here before we get on to the next bit of this. And that is Highlander. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure everyone's familiar with the plot behind Highlander, but basically there are immortals there. Quite spaced out through the ages, and the idea is that they're activated usually by a death, and then they come back, and then after that nothing will kill them except being beheaded, and generally the only person who can behead them is another immortal. They're all coming towards this great conjunction called the Gathering, at which point only one immortal can remain, etc. It's a very, very masculine take on immortality. And it's very noticeable that Highlander is basically an all-boys club. An all-white boys club as well, which is...
How strange, yeah.
Which is really interesting. Okay, it's of its time, and I won't say it's a favourite film, but it does do a few things quite nicely. As in some of the immortals, they... between the Highlander and Ramirez, the Spaniard, there's a friendship that forms, and Rhaenyra actually trains the Highlander.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of is willing to fight on behalf of the Highlander's wife, etc.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that with that, the main character in that, he falls in love with someone that, this is after being made outcast by his people for being a witch.
Yeah.
And they stone him and hang him and drive him out of the village. They finally can't kill him. And it, you know, it freaks them out. And you have to assume that people who discovered a true immortal might react the same way, except nowadays we'd probably stick them in a lab somewhere and try and replicate their DNA.
Yeah.
But in this case, he falls in love with someone, finds out that he can't ever give her children. She chooses to stay with him because she loves him. And it's a really, really sad, poignant story, that part. Because she grows old and she dies and he stays with her all the way through and they never stop loving each other. But you could say, well, she didn't waste her life because she lived the life that she chose.
Mm.
But at the same time, she'd wanted children and a big family and a farmstead and, you know, acceptance in the wider community, and she kind of had to give all of that up. And then later on you find out that he rescued a little girl during the Second World War.
Mm.
And it's only as you, I mean, the film sort of cuts back and forth from the past to the present being the 80s, so not really that present.
Yeah.
But he sort of runs an antique store in the 80s, and he has acquired a lot of money. I think if you've got lots of time, it's quite possible to make quite a lot of money over centuries and centuries, even if you're not very motivated. So he's, you know, relatively well off, and there's a woman working for him as his secretary, and you realise later that it's the same little girl he rescued during the war, and she knows, and she's kept his secret. She's sort of been his ward all these decades.
Yeah.
So there's some nice little touches there, but it's also a really, really troubling story.
It is. I want to give another example, actually, as well, which is, I say recent. There was a TV series called Forever, which I really liked, but they cancelled it after one season. Still well worth watching. In which there's a character called Dr. Henry Morgan, who was, I think he was born around the sort of in the 1800s. And what happens is that he ends up on a British gentleman. And he ends up on a slave ship, and he basically starts to, you know, this is the first time he's on one, and he's so appalled by what he sees, he starts to help orchestrate a breakout to sort of free everybody. But before he can do that, he gets caught, and he gets shot and thrown overboard.
Yeah.
Fortunately, you then find out that actually his breakout still worked, and that all the slaves got free and took the ship and, yeah, were basically free men, which is awesome. But he gets shot, and so he's in the water, and then he becomes an immortal, whereby whenever he gets killed, his body will disappear and he will emerge naked, usually. Always naked in the closest body of water to him.
Yeah.
So at this point, he works in. You then sort of jump to the future. He works as a mortician for the police department. And he lives with a guy named Abe. This old man named Abe, who runs an antique store. Must be something to do with antiques. Who knows. He works as this mortician, and the series literally starts with him on the underground, and then the underground, there's an accident, and he just sort of emerges naked in the river, which of course, you know, gets him into all sorts of trouble because he's technically works for the police department, and he keeps being found skinny dipping in the river, he's just in the middle of the day, so... Lots of questions there. But it's actually quite it's a really, really interesting story, and that one of the most poignant little touches is that you do find out that, yeah, Abe, the old guy he lives with, is actually his son, who, again, he adopted with his wife during the war, during World War II. Which is, it's really beautifully done, actually. It's fantastic, and their relationship is really lovely. But what you do find out is that he's not the only immortal. There's another immortal as well, who was actually in a concentration camp. This immortal is much older, significantly older. He was there around in Roman times, I believe. And he was in a concentration camp during the war, and they discovered that he was immortal. So they just experimented on him. He was the perfect task for them to do, because obviously that was happening, to do their medical experimentations on. And they just experimented on him over and over and over again, killing him over and over again, and basically drove him insane.
Yeah.
And both he and Henry are basically just desperately after a way for them to die, because they're like, we're both pretty tired, actually. And they theorise that actually the only way for them to die is to be killed, again, by the weapon that originally killed them.
Right.
It's actually a really, really interesting series, and I do highly recommend it, because it does explore the idea of immortality. But I quite like the fact that actually, as part of being immortal, they do actually die. They just keep coming back. But they do have to live with the trauma of dying over and over and over again, and the difficulties that it faces. And I do like the idea that it explores the psyche of actually what happens if this, you know, if you keep losing somebody. Because obviously this other threat that Henry has is that his son now is an old man.
Yeah.
And he knows that at some point his son is going to die. It's a very good series, so I do recommend it.
Yeah. Okay, so other issues with, you know, immortality in speculative fiction. One I've put separately is cruelty and avarice. And avarice doesn't necessarily need to mean, you know, concerned with wealth, etc. I think it's all to do with the alienation and the distancing of yourself from humanity, or the fact that you might actually genuinely have started off life as someone who's not quite right and doesn't see other people as real.
Hmm.
And somehow that's allowed you to grasp the concept of immortality and really go for it. And as I said, it would be really easy to set yourself up as this sort of god emperor figure, because yeah, you can't die. And sort of take on the idea that perhaps you should be ruling everything. And that is something that definitely gets explored an awful lot in various different iterations of this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But in which case you often have the evil immortal.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing to consider is that if you cannot choose to do something, then you're not free to not do it either. So or rather, if you cannot choose to not do something, then you're not free to do it. So while, you know, it's horrible to think that if you absolutely wanted to and needed to, that you would think of death as a way out and a release, if you have that option taken off the table, then you are just a prisoner.
Yeah.
You're not really living. You're kind of trapped.
I think imprisonment is definitely the right word for that.
Yeah.
It's, ultimately, it's the loss of choice, isn't it? But it's funny because we don't think of ourselves as, you know, having the choice of death. Because I guess in some ways, you know, it's the loss of it. It's the loss of, well, I can't die no matter what I do. So there's almost like this loss of meaning in everything that you do. Therefore,
yeah. Yeah, if something doesn't, it's the age-old question of, if you're going to live forever, then what are you living for?
Yeah,
what exactly grants meaning to your existence? So, before we get on to really deep drilling into some speculative fiction examples, let's look at a few things that are sort of, I want to say, more medieval, and I suppose they are more medieval in terms of when they really crystallised, although their origins come from much further back.
Mm.
So, first of all, I just want to have a brief discussion about alchemy. If you've ever seen an alchemy text, I don't know, actually if you have access to the Bodleian for some reason in Oxford, you can pop in and see some of these, and they are beautiful and amazing and whimsical and weird. Really, really weird. Alchemy texts were written in... Alchemy's kind of the progenitor of chemistry and physics and a little bit of mathematics. I mean, let's not forget that at one point, mathematics was considered a form of witchcraft.
Yes.
So, you know, it's worth bearing that in mind. You were kind of a heretic if you were too into your maths. Alchemy sort of draws on all of those things, and it's looking at ideas like balancing of humours in the human body. It sort of looked at early medicine at from a more esoteric point of view, and, you know, two of the greatest things that you would strive for in alchemical terms would be, one, the Philosopher's Stone, and two, the Elixir of Life, which was supposed to grant immortality. We're pretty sure that these were code, just like the fantastical beasts and things you see illustrating these alchemical texts quite often stand, we know in fact they stand for things like constellation positions, so the times of the year. We know they stand for things like mandrake or indigo root or various other things that were used in chemical compounds. Used to, you know, sometimes used to make early explosives. Some of this stuff worked, some of it really didn't work. And the whole idea of the Philosopher's Stone and the Elixir of Life was the Philosopher's Stone was making oneself whole as a person within oneself. So with rigors of intellect, of spirit, and fortitude, and of, you know, good health in your physical frame. It wasn't actually supposed to confer the ability to make a potion that would grant you immortality. It was supposed to make you whole for the next life. However, people came along 100 years after, got hold of some of these texts, and started taking them very literally. In fairness, things happened. Like, there was the Great Plague, which killed a lot of people and interrupted things, and also caused a panic and a sense of mortality in a very negative way.
Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting, and I particularly enjoy it when you have a speculative fiction book that draws on alchemy. I mean, I have to admit, I didn't love A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness because it was not great in terms of this. If you were writing Twilight for adults, but without the context of Twilight being about effectively teenagers, it reads very, very strangely. And also there's the whole vampire yoga scene, which seemed a bit unnecessary to me.
I have no idea what that even means, but thank you.
It was kind of like Matthew is supposed to be this, you know, the, as his absolute dreamboat vampire, and on the first date he takes the witch main character to a vampire yoga session. I'm not doing this justice, but it was very, very strange.
I'm just honestly a bit perplexed. I think if anyone took me on a date to a yoga session, I wouldn't be happy.
But what I did enjoy was the fact that yes, this dealt with some immortal creatures, but the main character, whose name has completely gone out of my head, I want to say Sarah, but I'm not sure it is, actually was, you know, she was a historian specialising in alchemical texts. So you get these really detailed descriptions of these beautiful texts and things, and of the libraries and things in Oxford, and that's always really interested me. So basically I was hanging in there for the backstory and the research, I guess, which isn't great, but I did enjoy that side of it.
I think probably when thinking about alchemy, well, I have to mention Full Metal Alchemist, which I really liked, because it, obviously it does draw a lot on alchemy, and obviously one of the main components within Full Metal Alchemist is the Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah.
And the thing I kind of liked about the way that they looked at alchemy in Fullmetal Alchemist was that actually it was really kind of veered toward it being a scientific kind of thing. Yes, it's a bit magical, but it was very scientific. I really liked that because obviously historically alchemy, you know, is the step, you know, chemistry and modern chemistry and things like that evolved from alchemy. Isaac Newton was an alchemist. He wasn't a scientist, as it were. And alchemy, therefore, is kind of that is it's early chemistry. And again, I do think the problem is that people take it very literally. And maybe there were people who did, you know, who were kind of very seriously looking for immortality and things like that. I wouldn't put it past anyone, considering what the Victorians got up to. But I do think that there is this common misconception, which is that people were only kind of interested in sort of one thing and were only concentrating on one thing, where if you look back, you know, you look at the Greeks, they were philosophers, playwriters, mathematicians, all in one go. It wasn't just a, right, this is my subject and I'm sticking to it. So the idea, therefore, that alchemists weren't actually being philosophers as well, and weren't actually looking at things in a slightly esoteric but in an ultimately philosophical way, you know, it's worth exploring. You said it much more eloquently than I did, Jules, but you get what I mean.
No, I think you made a good point there. I think the idea that the schools of thought were not separated is something that heavily influenced the whole subject of alchemy. Yeah. And certainly influenced the less informed later understanding of it, which is, you know, that's kind of when we think of alchemy as dating from, but actually it kind of dated from much earlier and wasn't considered quite such a faux pas.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can say what we like about the Christian church, certainly when we're talking in Europe, in this country, in historical terms, but we would not have had medical developments and science, scientific developments and things without the church, because for everyone who sort of wanted to burn heretics and wanted to keep people dirt poor and ignorant, there were monks who were kind of like, yeah, this, my life is in service to God and in prayer and in philosophy and in creating beautiful illuminated manuscripts, but also in studying things like genetics, even though it wasn't called genetics at the time.
Yeah.
Think of Gregor Mendel, for example. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting. And, you know, science for them had a soul. It had this, as you say, esoteric side to it. So this is probably why I find it fascinating, because it's kind of like chemistry, which I like, but sexy. Sexy chemistry.
Sexy chemistry. Chemistry that comes in, you know, with a little, with a cloak.
Basically. Now, we couldn't really do this episode without a little bit of a discussion on immortal creatures. And we have, you know, probably the best known is obviously the vampire. We've done an episode on, in fact, we've touched on vampires in at least two different ways. But we'll look at the immortality side of vampires, because I think that's quite an interesting one.
Hmm. Yeah. So, vampires have always interested me, because they became rather sexy, and really you can mostly blame, Carmilla for that, but also really Dracula.
Yeah, and
but not
and
even
then,
original Dracula, like TV Dracula.
Well, I mean, you can blame original Dracula a little bit, because all the really, really disgusting stuff that would have been in the original book of Dracula, Bram Stoker's editors made him cut it out. So all the stuff that would have made it even more monstrous and repellent rather than slightly attractive and also repellent was taken out, which I find quite interesting.
Yeah,
but
it occur to me that all the female vampires are actually all quite good looking, but Dracula himself is just sort of a bit horrid looking.
Yes, and yet still compelling somehow. But there's obviously you're going on to sort of the silent film era. If you look at the film Nosferatu, for example, which now it's probably quite amusing, but at the time this was cutting edge, even though that you can definitely see the string on the bat, for example, or the moment when it's a case of, no, we've stopped the film and exchanged the person for a pile of dust. It's great. Oh, it's a classic. But then you go on to the ones that it's that made way for the Hammer horror film, and then you've got Bela Lugosi looking incredibly debonair as the Count. And that's when Dracula started to become genuinely quite sexy. And you can pretty much lay the entire spectrum of vampire fiction at those sources, at the sort of like, yeah, these are highly, highly sexed creatures that live forever, creatures of forever, who get by on drinking human blood. Folklorically, I don't think that's a word. In folklore, that's better. In folklore, vampires did not particularly drink blood. They drank human bodily fluids of all kinds. There are very, very few of them that actually bothered with blood. And you didn't have to get bitten by one in order to become a vampire. It was enough to die with hatred in your heart.
Yeah. And, you know, the whole thing of the vampire is ultimately they were... The whole point of the drinking the bodily fluid is that it was about draining life force.
Yes.
And, you know, to be bitten by one wasn't necessarily to become a vampire, but rather to become sick, usually, or maybe to, you know, to start to lose energy, or, you know, any number of things which might occur in a small, you know, rural, poor environment where people have happened to be dying and you don't have that great hygiene. You know, all of these things could be explained away or whatever. And and also the vampires themselves, the whole biting of the neck thing is quite sexy. But I think I'm pretty sure that when you did used to get bitten, it was one bite in the chest.
Or the wrist, or something like that.
Yeah.
I think the thing, that's again something we can put down to the film era because, okay, black and white films, but you had usually a blonde beauty, risque, very risque in a negligee of some kind, pulling aside the collar of her nightgown or what have you.
Yeah.
And it was a sexual simulation. It was very much a case of, oh, look, she's been penetrated by these teeth. And it was supposed to, yeah, exactly. It was incredibly titillating for sort of 1920s, 1930s.
Yeah.
Even if people didn't realise that that's what was affecting them. And you only looking at it analytically now, it's kind of like, yeah, this is still getting people off now. So.
Yeah. Hooray!
But yes, yeah, sorry, the immortality side of vampires, we got a bit sidetracked there by the neck biting. As Madeline said, it was all about stealing life to preserve life, which is the interesting angle, I think, with vampires in the sense of, yes, they will live forever unless, you know, someone stakes them or they get exposed to sunlight or what have you.
Yeah.
But in order to function and maintain youth and physical and mental power, and some of these powers are quite spooky, they need to steal that life from other people.
Yeah.
And it does, and in the way of true parasites, it does always lead to the victim dying, even if they don't then become vampires themselves.
Yes. Yeah. It's also very interesting because I think that something about vampires, which is sort of forgotten, is that they're actually already dead.
Yeah.
And then the original vampires, you know, within folklore, it's not that they're immortal so much as they're kind of living on borrowed life.
Yeah.
But if they're cut off from their feeding, they, you know, they'll die. They'll disappear. I say they'll die, they'll just stop living, if that makes sense. It's this weird thing, but you do have to remember they are actually technically already dead.
Yeah.
It's more like they're lingering, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of distinction between a vampire and a hungry ghost, or even one of the Fae.
Yeah.
In some of the early folklore.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you could put them all into one thing. It's great because in certain parts of the, you know, the country, or even in, you know, parts of Ireland and things like that, it's just something drinking your blood, it's a fae. Something haunting your house, it's a fae. So like, it's all fae. It's fairies. The distinction really wasn't that, you know, that there wasn't this massive distinction. And of course, the word vampire, it comes from Eastern Europe. It's Eastern European. But yeah, so immortality in that sense is actually quite interesting. In terms of other creatures, immortal creatures, this is going to sound like a little tangent, but one thing that I always remembered is in the Percy Jackson books. Have you read any of them?
No.
Well, in the Percy Jackson books, there's this concept where all of the sort of the Greek monsters, you know, like the Cyclops, the Minotaur, things like that, you can kill them, but after a little bit of time, they'll respawn.
Yeah, that's something that you get in Tamora Pierce's Wild Magic series, her Immortals Quartet, rather.
Yeah.
Obviously the main character, spoiler alert guys, but I've talked about this a lot and the books have been out for 20 years. So the main character is actually a demigoddess in her own right, which is something she doesn't really discover until the third book.
Hmm.
By the fourth book, they actually end up accidentally visiting the realms of the gods. And when they say gods, it's kind of like the first of anything. So the first beaver, the first badger, the first lion, all of those are gods in their own rights. And, you know, they're gods of their chosen people. So, you know, the first beaver and the first female beaver are the god and goddess of the beavers.
Mm.
It sounds very cutesy, but actually it's kind of not, because the gods have got, like, all those animal behaviours, but amplified and with human intelligence as well.
Yeah.
And the main character is the daughter of Wirin, the hunt god. So we would say Herne the Hunter or Canonus. From the Celtic mythology, that's basically who it is.
Mm.
So she's a good huntress, and she's got a real way with animals, and she can actually shapeshift into various different animals as well.
Yeah.
And she could, at one point, she's offered the choice. She can stay in the realms of the gods because she is divine enough that she could stay there and become a minor goddess in her own right. The idea being that you have the great gods, but the great gods are still physical beings who cannot be everywhere at once, and therefore they sort of delegate tasks to the minor gods.
Yes.
And it's the same if you die as an immortal if you die as an immortal, then you get reborn immediately into another body. So you've got all these animal gods who are all doing what animal gods do, and kind of like the bear is eating the salmon, and the salmon is also a god and kind of respawns itself. I mean, it kind of sucks to be like the god of the fruit fly, or, you know.
Yeah.
The god of chickens.
I am the god of chickens.
Not that we ever meet the god of chickens, but you just imagine the most put upon animal you can and think about being that god, the one everyone preys upon, so you end up respawning five or six times a day.
Yeah. That sounds like fun.
Really good series, but yeah, as you say, it's that true immortality in the sense of literally cannot be killed because they will just keep coming back.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily something you get from gods in Greek myths, because quite often they cannot kill each other, and so they do terrible other things to each other. There's terrible punishments they have to live through instead.
Like Prometheus.
Like any of the Titans, like Hera being chained to the sky with chains of gold by her husband.
God, Zeus really is the worst.
Oh, he sucked. Yeah, he really was. But there's also the idea that, you know, sometimes the gods can die as well. An interesting exploration of that I found is in Giants of the Frost by Kim Wilkins, and it looks at Nordic tradition and the fact that Ragnarok is coming one day, and the fact that most of the gods have been alive so long, they have lost contact with their people. And they're just mean, and they're like nine parts insane, and they really only feel anything when they're doing something cruel. And yeah. There's one or two gods who aren't really like that. Loki, because he's always interacted with humanity,
yeah.
is following his own agenda, but very much still, you know, sane of a kind.
Yeah.
And Vidar, the silent god, the god of silent death and assassins, fell in love with a human girl sort of 800 years before.
Mm.
And, his father did not like that very much and had her killed. And he's never really forgiven him for that, but that meant he moved away from living with the Aesir and lived by himself and just continued to interact with his family as little as possible and stayed relatively sane. And then it looks like the girl's been reincarnated again, and the romance starts to pick up where it was before, and Odin takes pretty much the same dim view of it he did before.
Ah, great.
And the real problem is that in Norse mythology, it's Vidar who is supposed to set his foot against the jaws of the Fenris Ulf in order to grab Odin as Odin is being swallowed. And then Odin at that point is supposed, by prophecy, to get reborn, and a new age of the gods begins. And of course, Vidar's got to the point where it's like, I actually don't care if the Fenris Ulf eats you.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I don't think this is not the destiny I want. It's a really, really good book, a really interesting take on the mythology, but it's quite bleak. I will warn you in advance.
That's a really, really interesting idea.
But I like the way that in quite a lot of these mythologies and things, when a prophecy about a god's death comes about, they start to act really nuts, as in super paranoid. And the sort of crazy measures they take to preserve their own immortal lives, rather than saying, well, I guess everything must end eventually and I've had a good 8,000 years.
It's interesting because we often ascribe this kind of, they're immortal, but we think of their strange behaviour in terms of the fact that they're gods, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Rather than actually applying the idea that maybe their behaviour is strange because they're immortal.
Yeah, that's also a good point.
Looking at Irish mythology, for instance, I've talked in the past about my theories on where the idea of the Tuatha De Danann came from. Whereas, of course, you know, you have the invasion cycle, which is of Ireland, which is just all about their invasion history, and the Tuatha De Danann arrived and pushed out the Fomori that were there. They had a huge battle. I think there was someone else there as well. I can't remember who it was, but the point is that they took over, and then the Milesians arrived and they chased they pushed the Tuatha De Danann underground, in a country which is full of burial mounds. Like, I don't think that's, you know. Very obviously, the whole concept is that the Tuatha De Danann were considered to be the people who existed before, the ancestors. They were human, and even in some of the ways in which they're described, there is a human-like quality to them. They're not necessarily godly. They have magic, they have powers, but they are quite human, and yet the connection between the Fae and the dead is incredibly strong. But you can't help but think that in their origin there is a humanity to them. And perhaps the thing which has robbed them of that humanity is death. And the reason that they're so, or rather immortality through death, and the reason that they're so uncanny is because they have had that one element of humanity removed from them through death, which is kind of the only way to do it.
Yeah, definitely. I think, we talked about lost cities a couple of weeks ago. Basically, if you look at the Livergavla Eren, when it talks about the part of the Tuatha De Danann, the children of Danu, they were supposed to have come out of the north and they were returning. They weren't really invading. They'd been driven out by the Fëanor before, and they were they'd actually been sort of enslaved, and they were returning, having gathered strength and advanced. The word doesn't translate very well, and people translate the word both as magic and as science in the north. And it's really interesting that once again, you know, we talked about sinking of various lost cities and lost continents and things. But again, this is sort of another concurrent, the invasion of the sea people type thing. They came from the sea, they invaded us, they had superior technology. That's essentially the story of the Tuatha De Danann.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very, Sorry, I could get really into this, so I'm not going to talk about it too much. But yeah, the implications of immortality and actually how it's been used in mythology and fiction are great. And I do actually kind of want to mention one myth, which is also the idea that immortality exists for the Tuatha Dé Danann, very particularly if you live in, you know, on Chirananog, you know, the Isle of Youth, the Isle of the Ever Living, and things like that, which kind of has this sort of nod towards even the idea of paradise, you know, a place where souls go and you live eternally. We kind of have that in pretty much in a lot of mythos. There's this, and after death, there is a place of eternity. And one of my favourite myths from the Fenian cycle is of Oisin and Niamh. And Oisin is human. He's a human man, the son of Finn Mac Coul, who fell in love with the goddess Niamh. And he went off with her to Chirnanog. And they lived very happily. They had two children. The timeline gets a bit weird because one of his children, Oscar, goes and joins the Fenian fight. But anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that Oisin is on Chernanog and he suddenly goes, I really kind of want to go back to Ireland and just see what things are like. And Niamh goes, well, time works a bit differently. Everything's changed. But he's so longing for it, she lets him go on the understanding that he isn't to get off the horse that he's been given to ride across to it. So he rides across and hundreds of years have passed and the island that he knew is gone and the people that he knew are gone and now instead are sort of these people who he perceives as being much smaller and much weaker. And as he leans down to help a group of people who are trying to lift a wagon, I think it is, a cart or something. The girth of the saddle, I think it snaps, and he falls to the ground. And the moment he falls to the ground, he withers and ages. And in some versions, St. Patrick quickly hurries over and goes, convert to Christianity! And Oisin goes, no! And dies. In some other versions, he literally just touches the ground and basically turns to dust.
Yeah.
I do like the quick hurried over of St. Patrick, like, I sense something, and he just rushes over.
To be honest, if you went into all the myths that St. Patrick suddenly turns up in, he'd have to be a time traveller.
He would be. I really do like that idea, which is that he was only immortal because he was in a certain place where time didn't exist, as it were, where time was kind of paused.
Yeah.
And it's a very different kind of immortality. Whereas rather than time being paused for you, time is paused for the whole world that you happen to exist in.
It's like, have you ever read the book or seen the film? And it's an old film now, I've got to say, made by the same Hammer Horror Company. Disturbed me greatly as a child. It's one of those films my dad exposed me to. It's called She by Rider Haggard, and basically it's an archaeological expedition going out into the desert, mm-hmm. and on the basis of having heard rumors, they're not just kind of like, oh, there's a desert there, let's go and see if we can find some ruins kind of thing. There is some method in the madness, and there's rumours of She Who Must Be Obeyed. They don't know her name. There might be this ancient civilization out there still waiting to be found. Mm. Long story short, they do in fact find it. And the queen, this beautiful woman, who in the film was played by Ursula Andress, so you can kind of like, yeah, okay, you can kind of see where you're coming from there, is a terrible, terrible, cruel person who has lived for hundreds and hundreds of years, and yet she is also beautiful and charming and engaging. And knowing all of this, the leader of the expedition kind of falls in love with her, and then she shows him his own past, and he realizes that he's a reincarnation and that they were lovers before, except that she stepped into the blue fire that granted immortality and he did not. But he's come back to her. And she said, well, we'll have the ritual and you'll be my immortal husband, etc. And it all gets really quite horrific, but when the Knight of the Blue Flame igniting comes again, he cannot bring himself to step into the fire. You know, there's something so repugnant about it. So she says, look, you know, come with me, my love. It's not something that you need to fear. And she steps back into it, holding his hands. And he goes into it with her. But of course, she's already bathed in the blue fire before, so it starts to take her immortality back. And while he's there receiving his immortality, she's turning into an old crone, and then into a skeleton, and then into dust in his hands.
Oh,
it's one of Haggard's more disturbing stories, but it was it's always been kind of a fascinating, repulsive favourite of mine. But it's interesting because it does kind of draw on that body of myth, sort of from Irish and also from other sources, where, you know, what you have could be taken from you. It's like the four fair children of Lear. I always felt that was a very unfair story, because when they finally regain their human forms, they're just little old men and women. They all fall down dead.
Yeah. It's incredibly sad, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you can be immortal while you're swans. And I also felt particularly for Fiula in that particular story, because her three brothers, while they were swans, they did not keep their human minds. They were just swans that seemed to live a very long time. Fiula, being cleverer than her brothers, kept a record of the centuries and centuries that they were trapped in swan form.
Yeah.
So that seemed really unfair. Anyway. I think we've just got time to look at some... Actually, I'm just going to sweep back to vampires very briefly, because when we were talking about sexy vampires, I didn't mention Anne Rice, and it feels kind of criminal not to do so. I have to admit, I've enjoyed a few Anne Rice books. I like her witches slightly more than I like her vampires, and I realise that readers of the Vampire Chronicles will now be throwing stones at me in the street, and I'm very sorry, but that's how I feel. The Vampire Chronicles is kind of like supposedly the pinnacle of dark, horrific, and, you know, sort of homoerotic literature. And they are really, really good. Yeah. It's just that the witches interest me more. The vampires, what's really interesting is that she really goes into and explores this disconnection with time and place. So obviously you have Lestat being the favourite character. And when he was made into a vampire by Marius, he, you know, it was several hundred years before, and he gradually, you know, he's vital, he's a connection for Marius with the time period he finds himself in. And then later, obviously, Lestat goes off on his own, etc. And he creates Louis again because he needs a connection with the time period he's in. I think only sort of 150 years passed, so comparatively little time. And Louis provides kind of a connection. And Louis is not keen when it comes to his turn, and he realises he's losing connection, which is why he has this whole... why he has the whole interview with a vampire thing, where he talks to a reporter about his life as an immortal. He's having difficulty connecting once again. But he doesn't want to curse anybody else to this life, this constant life of eventually becoming irrelevant, becoming an anachronism, and being emotionally disconnected from everything, to becoming ultimately a monster.
Yeah.
The reporter obviously turns around at the end of the interview and begs him to make him an immortal, and Louis gets very pissed off about it. It's really interesting, some of the directions that Anne Rice takes the Chronicles in. Nobody's really a good guy, nobody's really a bad guy. I mean, you have definitely worse vampires, like Akasha, the Queen of the Damned, the queen of all the vampire race, is entirely made up of bloodlust and cruelty. I mean, she's fascinating and beautiful, but she's also just kind of like, all of my children are here to serve me. And the human race are less than dogs, kind of thing.
Yay!
So,
hooray!
I think it's interesting because it's looking at the ennui. There's one point where Lestat kind of sort of like, he's bored of living. He's bored and almost depressed of living, to the point where he just gets into a tomb and wills himself to sleep for about 80 years.
Yeah. Sorry, this reminds me of two things. One is, I don't know whether you saw it, but when lockdown started, Michael Sheen and David Tennant and Neil Gaiman all put together and created a Good Omens in lockdown, which was great fun. And the thing I really like about it is Crowley just being like, I'm going to sleep until wake me up in July. but it was the first time when he said wake me up in July, it was the first time I suddenly thought, yeah, these guys are actually immortals, aren't they? Time has very little meaning to
them. What's interesting about those particular, the fallen angel and an angel, is the fact that they still have purpose. They have purpose that is imposed upon them, both from above and below, and by the ineffable plan. So, yes, they have immortality, but it hasn't lost all meaning because of this imposed outside purpose.
And the other thing I think about is actually a vampire character. I recently, finally, watched series 3 of Castlevania.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's just this one line of Alucard lying in the bed, and he's tossing and turning, and he puts his, he puts his arms over his chest in that very typical "I'm a corpse" fashion, and then he lies there and he opens his eyes. He goes, "Maybe I should get a coffin." And it's just there, like, because he's actually technically only a teenager.
Yeah,
he's very young. But he's already bored of immortality. He's not having a good time of it. But yeah, obviously the whole thing with Dracula and that as well. Who's then still alive in some capacity because he's apparently in hell.
Yes.
So, yeah. Anyway, sorry, small tangent, but I had to mention them.
Right, so we've probably just got time for a couple of our favourite immortals in fiction.
Okay, so my favourite immortals in fiction, well, probably actually Crowley and Aziraphale.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I think that they are very up there on the top of the list. I do quite like fiction which depicts sort of Norse or Greek, or rather Norse or sort of Celtic gods, so I would definitely include them as well. But I think I probably will also mention Dr. Henry Morgan from Forever, who is really rather sweet. So that's my card. The problem is you're going to say some others and I'm going to be like, oh yeah, those guys as well.
I've mentioned quite a few of mine. Most unusually for us, we haven't mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But I would actually put Spike down as a favourite immortal because he is immortal, but he's also possibly one of the most human characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of really engaging with life and fucking up and, getting back on the horse. And so I find that really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And obviously I mentioned Giants of the Frost by Kim Wilkins. I do like Vidar. Vidar's my favourite Norse god, even though we know so little about him.
I actually very recently watched a series called Noragami.
Yeah.
Which someone suggested to me and I watched it, and it's actually quite a fun little series. And there is this OVA. One of the characters is basically a god, which means that he can actually die, if he's killed by specific weaponry or under other circumstances. But he can't die by human means. And there's an OVA, which is just complete silliness, where they all happen to be on holiday, and there's a serial killer who wants to basically murder everybody, and he decides that Yattle, this god, is going to be his first victim.
Yeah.
But then, so he kills Yattle, but then Yattle revives. And so then he keeps trying to kill him, and he keeps failing and not understanding why, this guy won't die, and it becomes steadily more ridiculous. Like, to begin with, he just bashes his head in, then he feeds him pesticides, then he shoots him with an arrow, then he sort of shoots him with a machine gun, he sets him on fire, he ties him up and throws him in the ocean.
It's a bit sort of Rasputin, the Russian queen.
Exactly. And it's actually quite a fun little bit.
It doesn't sound fun.
Well, no, not. I think my favourite bit is he gets fed the pesticides and he just starts choking, and then he grabs a small pot which has got roses in it, and he just drinks the water out of the pot. And when he pulls the pot away and he's got a rose between his teeth, and he's like, oh, those foolish chefs. if I hadn't been, you know, if I hadn't been a that might have actually really sort of inconvenienced me or something like that. Like, if I had been a locust, he said, if I had been a locust, that would have killed me dead. the serial killer's like, no, but seriously, that pesticide is illegal in Japan. I don't know how you're still alive. But it's actually, yeah, it's a very funny little thing. And so I think I probably actually quite like that as well.
Cool.
Sorry, I thought I just mentioned that.
I did say that I would explain the bit about the gods, these immortals being beheaded and then regrowing heads. Basically, we have talked about these books before because I did not like the way the series ended. But this is the Immortal Prince series by Jennifer Fallon, and the books are beautifully world-building, richly imagined, complicated characters. And the immortals have been alive for thousands of years, and they are so bored, and, you know, to the point where they have created entirely new species with magic and genetic breeding programs and things. They've gone through the whole phase of setting themselves up as gods and being worshipped, and then got bored of it and moved on to other things. So they've seen the entire civilization of this world sort of rise and fall and rise again. It's, as I said, the idea that being beheaded sort of reduces them to a younger mental state without the experiences, but they still will regrow ahead.
Yes. Oh, actually, I completely forgot an immortal who I absolutely adore.
Okay.
The Monkey King from Journey to the West. Sun Wukong. There is a particular story, which I have to share with you because you mentioned the beheading, where Sun Wukong basically, there's a lot of dumb fuckery, but essentially he gets challenged to like this competition with these three immortal deists, and they have to go through these three kind of challenges. So the first one is being beheaded.
Yeah.
So Sun Wukong's like, yeah, sure, okay, I'll get beheaded first. So he gets beheaded, and his head sort of rolls away. And what happens is that one of the immortals grabs the head and holds it down so that it won't return to Sun Wukong. Because this is a thing, apparently, if your head returns to you, you can be fine. So Sun Wukong is like, tries to call his head back. It doesn't work, so he just regrows a new head. when the immortal tries it, then the head comes off. Sun Wukong grabs hold of the head in the same way, but this guy can't regrow his head, so he dies. Yeah. Second immortal goes through a test where he says, all right, well, we'll be disemboweled. So they go through some horrifying... So Sun Wukong's like, great, fantastic, I've actually had a bit of a stomachache, so actually getting a little bit of an airing would be good. So they disembowel him horrifically, and then afterwards he's like, "Ooh, that's great, thank you." They disembowel the immortal, and Sun Wukong, very Prometheus-esque, gets someone to come in, steal the liver or something, and thereby killing the immortal. And then the final one is just, they're like, "All right, we're going to literally sit in a pot of boiling oil," and Sun Wukong's like, "Oh, well, you know, my skin's been a bit dry, so I think, yeah, that'd be great." And of course, he's absolutely fine. And then when the immortal tries to do it, Song Wukong realizes, hold on a second, this is cold. It's not actually hot. So he calls, because there's a little fire dragon which is preventing him from actually burning. So he calls someone in, gets it really hot, and basically he kills all of these people. And everyone has a good time about it. But I think the regrowing the head is my favourite moment of all of the stories.
That is absolutely batshit.
It's fantastic. So yeah, Journey to the West is an incredible, incredible story. So yeah, highly recommended.
Okay, well, I think that takes us to the end of our episode on immortality.
I think it does. Before we go, of course, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes. Obviously, we've talked about Penny Dreadful a lot before. I don't know if anyone has yet watched Penny Dreadful: City of Angels, which is sort of the spiritual heir to Penny Dreadful. It's got a slightly different tone, but it's incredibly good. So, obviously, the original Penny Dreadful set during the late Victorian period, very much sort of the Gothic. This is set during the 1930s in Los Angeles. And you're looking at things like the race riots between the Mexican population and obviously the white population as well.
Yeah.
You have Jewish communities, you have the whole various different gangs that were starting to get their feet on the ground. World War II is brewing, there's Nazi parties, you know, all the sort of restrictions that you would have expected. Early ecstatic type church movements. So it's a really interesting melting pot and time in history. And in the midst of all this, you have Santa Muerte, who is she's essentially her cult is an offspring of the Catholic Church, very particular to sort of that area of the world, and also to, you know, possibly to Spain as well. No one's absolutely sure where the cult started. It may well have started in sort of South America. It may well have started much earlier and travelled with sort of the Romani and the carnival tradition through Europe. But she is Saint Death. She is the goddess of death. She's known by many, many names. And basically she's the personification of your own personal death. When it's time for you to die, she will appear to you and take you into her arms. In theory, she's actually a comforting figure. If you dig into the mythology a little bit more, she's potentially not quite so comforting, because she may well be a personification of the Aztec goddess of death, who is far less concerned about the whole giving you a comforting journey to the next world thing.
Right.
Anyway, here she's portrayed, if not as good, at least as well-intentioned as one's personal death can be. Against her is set Magda. Magda is effectively a demoness. She's Santa Muerte's sister, La Sanissima Negra, so the Dark Lady, basically. She's not necessarily bad either, but her perspective is that all of mankind is highly corruptible, particularly men. And so it's almost like this quiet spiritual war has been fought, and the battleground is the human soul. And it's not so much that she feeds off it, it's just that she can prove, she wants to prove that she's right, that humans are corruptible, and therefore they can be corrupted quite easily into leading each other into death. And I think one line encapsulates it perfectly in the first episode. She says, "Hold out your arms, sister, I will fill it with so many souls." And that's literally what she does. You know, you wouldn't say that she was necessarily behind the race riots, but she's the person tweaking the strings which make an already flammable situation really go up like rocket fuel. And yet there are times when she's really pulling the strings as hard as she can, and people are going, "No, actually, I don't want to let hatred into my heart." And you can see how frustrated she's getting. "Will you just murder him? For God's sake, just be a good Nazi.
Would you please?"
It's almost literally the words. It's really interesting. I think there's a second season, because they have definitely not given away all their cards here. It's really, really clever, and they've really done their research and employed people to read sensitively as to whether they're portraying different cultures in a way that's actually accurate and representational.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard the concept of a Nazi who isn't a bad person, because I kind of, those two things seem to go hand in hand.
That's because we're coming from the perspective of being after World War II. There was a movement that became Nazis, if you like. And before that, yes, they were very much, we would like German pride, we would like decency. I mean, think about how ground down the Germans were after World War I by pretty much everyone. They were starving and, you know, they were occupied and, you know, we were not good people there.
No.
So it's perfectly understandable that there was a movement that wanted to do right, but they weren't necessarily about being cruel and oppressing other people either, which then became the Nazi Party, because the minute you start being sort of like, no, this is about us, you're very highly corruptible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I can definitely understand that initial movement, particularly of a people, yeah, who were really put in a terrible position, which we were responsible, really, which bred that kind of hatred, and using something which actually has a pure or a well-meaning intention to create hostilities is definitely something which certain politicians have definitely gotten good at. So yeah, okay, that's an interesting idea.
It's like, put it this way, there's a moment in the first episode where you see the guy who is, you know, a German expatriate, basically, who has settled in America and had two half-German, half-American children with his American heiress wife.
Mm.
And he's out sort of talking in public, really talking to his German brethren and to his American cousins, etc. And yet behind him there is a swastika on a flag, and you think, oh my god, he must be a terrible person. He's actually not a terrible person at all, and he doesn't describe himself as being a Nazi, but he is very much sort of like, no, we must regain German pride. I cannot see my people ground down into the dirt like this anymore. And then you find out things about his past and realise that actually he has taken deliberate steps not to let this hatred of other people rule him. And it's interesting that, yes, in some ways he is corruptible, but in other ways he's really, really fighting it. So it's an interesting perspective. It's certainly not trying to say, yes, the Nazis were originally the good guys.
Yeah.
And then they got pushed too far one day.
Yeah.
No. It was just one Jew. That's how it starts, kind of thing. And they're not doing that at all. It's a really intelligent look at all history, I suppose.
Yeah.
Perspectives.
Because I do think that actually a lot of people forget that the first place that the Nazis occupied was Germany.
Yes.
And that there were just ordinary people there who wanted what was best for their country, but weren't necessarily all about murdering everybody else.
No. And I think it then becomes an omelettes and eggs argument. It becomes a case of, well, these people want to grind us into the dirt and starve us to death and rape us in the street. And these people are kind of like against that. So I guess we're with them, even if they are kind of murdering people.
Yeah, absolutely. On that note.
Sorry, I think the thing is, I assume that if I know something, then everybody knows it. And obviously that's not the case.
No.
So I did not explain myself fully the first time around.
No. But on that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening, guys. And we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.